The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Albina Asmanova teaches at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies, and she is the author of a book called Capitalism on the Edge. It's Monday, January 20th, 2020, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of the Zero Books podcast and the publishing manager for Zero Books. I should also mention that we have a Patreon. If you like this podcast and want to help us become a patron and get access to multiple podcasts, including a new podcast called Pop the Left. The music you're listening to right now is the Internationale. Albina Asmanova teaches at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies, where she chairs the postgraduate program in international political economy. And we participated on a panel on the subject of the future of socialism at the Battle of Ideas back in November of last year. That's where we met, and I was glad to participate with that. And her book, Capitalism on the Edge, is out from Columbia University Press. Albina, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you very much, Doug. I'm very happy to be on the program indeed.
Do you have anything to add to your bio or any backstory you want to get into before we jump into all these prepared questions that I sent you?
Well, I'm very aware that my take on capitalism, socialism, these things is affected by my growing up under the old regime, you know, the dictatorship in my native Bulgaria. I'm born in 1968, so I really grew up under that regime. And I was one of the dissidents. I became a dissident rather inadvertently by joining an environmental committee that didn't have the blessing of the party. So indeed, my take is colored by this experience. First fighting state socialism and then leaving for New York and starting to my critique of capitalism. So I'm bad that way.
I suppose that I come from a more Marxist perspective, and having grown up in the United States, I can have the luxury of not having ever experienced even a labor party, let alone a communist party. Well, I'll tell you this as a kind of background before we get started sort of debating these topics. This morning, before I interviewed you, I interviewed a group of Marxists in Germany. They're part of the I'm going to call it the value theory Marxists. Their work critic is the name of their tendency, and they have a journal called Crisis, which they started in the mid or early 80s. Their whole perspective is that as far back as the early 80s, there was a need to break from traditional Marxism. There were two reasons why. One is that it didn't the new social movements around feminism and anti-colonialism and all of that had been a major influence on their thinking, but also the failure of the Soviet Union and the coming – I mean, they started their journal a few years before the Berlin Wall came down, right? I mean, they were living in West Germany. So they were aware that there were limits to the kind of traditional Marxism that had defined a certain part of the left for a long time. And so when I am trying to advocate for what I consider to be a kind of a Marxist vision of capitalism and a need to get beyond it, I'm not trying to advocate for a state-centric socialism as it was known in the Soviet Union. I come from a sect of the Marxist left that thinks that the Soviet Union was state capitalist.
Right. I would agree with that. Actually, we were, as I say in the introduction of my book, we fought for authentic communism, what we were promised but never delivered. So I would define myself as a liberal socialist. I see myself as a Marxist, but not in the traditional sense, which Marx himself, by the way, rejected. He said that he's not a Marxist. If Marxism is some sort of an abstract science spelling out non-historical laws that are always valid. So I'm trying to return to the historicist type of analysis that Marx himself valued. So to look at the contradictions of our times and to see, you know, to see how from within we can subvert the system.
The premise of your book is that we are now living through an era of precarity capitalism, and that the social and political problems facing us are indicators not necessarily of a need for radical change, but rather they indicate that we must be careful to avoid being caught up in discourses that will maybe keep us trapped in the past, discourses advocating for populism or radicalism. So for you, the aim shouldn't be to overthrow capitalism or to stabilize capitalism, but rather to overcome it. What do you think the difference is between overcoming and overthrowing?
Okay, first I want to make a slight correction. I'm not saying that there is no need for radical change. I'm all for radical change. But my reading of the current moment that we inhabit is that precarity, and by precarity I mean the massive destabilization of people's lives, of the rich and the poor, of the well-educated and the poorly educated. So there's this massive precariousness that capitalism has triggered. And this is actually nurturing, it is nurturing reactions of preservation, of conservative instincts, even reactionary, as we have seen. So I'm just not holding my breath for the standard, the old-fashioned political revolution, capturing the, you know, the will of power and expropriating private property. You know, so I simply do not think this is in the cards, and we need to find another way. So the way I propose is this kind of what I call subverting or overcoming by subverting the system rather than overthrowing it with a political revolution. I simply do not see such a revolution in the offing.
Your objection actually to a revolutionary struggle is not that different in some ways, I guess, than from the people I was talking to earlier today, which is they felt that for different reasons, not just because of precarity was creating reactionary impulses in people and therefore they were unlikely to struggle in a revolutionary way, but also because a revolutionary struggle that started with the seizure of state power was always going to go wrong based on their analysis of the commodity and all that kind of thing. So they felt that there needed to be a change at the level of social relations around production, and rather than a change in political structure or political who had political power.
That's right.
So yeah,
that's right. And I would say even that understanding radical change as nationalization of property or holding property in public hands, be it state or, let's say, workers holding the property together, is not radical enough, because we might very well imagine a society where the property is held by the workers, everybody's paid the same, so the issue with the inequality is solved, and still this society can be committed to the pursuit of profit that has been so horrible for people, communities, and nature. Now take, well, the Soviet type of regimes. that I have lived under take quasi-communist, China. So it is not even anymore a matter of property. It is not the class struggle in that sense. We need to go beyond that, and that is why I position my analysis away from issues of property, class struggle, and onto what I consider the main dynamic of capitalism, and this is the competitive pursuit of profit. So competition, the productivist nature of work, and above everything, profit. So
right, but you're not going to be able to get away from profit as long as you are continuing the wage relationship, and as long as what's being produced are commodities for sale in the market. In other words, to be real Marxist about it, as long as what we're producing, as long as what's directing our production is the need for exchange, if we're producing for exchange, then we are not going to be able to get rid of the profit motive, even if it's on a national scale.
Right. So very often capitalism is described as a market economy. It is not. So markets, exchange of products that are there to satisfy human needs, have always existed. It is not a peculiarity of capitalism. The markets in as exchange of goods, right? That's clear. And I'm not saying that you are arguing that, but we really need to keep reminding people that capitalism is not simply about exchange of goods and satisfaction of needs. You know, capitalism, first, it inflates needs, and then it creates needs and then satisfies them, exactly in order to create profit, right, to make capital grow. So it is not even the wage relationship, but the fact that people's livelihoods more and more get tied up to the creation of profit. So why are doctors, at least in Europe, paid much less than bankers? It is because bankers stay very close, they're closer to where profits are made. So the more remote somebody is from where profit is made, the less they're paid.
The where profit is made primarily is on the shop floor. Where profit comes from, according to a Marxist understanding, is from the exploitation of labor time. And you are saying that now bankers are make more than doctors. Well, they make more than doctors because they're close to financialization, but that's not really the source of value, of the production of surplus value and actual profit. I mean, I should distinguish between profit and surplus value, I suppose. But you can't really break those two things apart. And the kind of fictional capital that's in the financial market, or the speculative capital in investment that goes on there, is all reliant on this wage relationship and exploitation of workers. So if you – and there is no wage relationship without the creation of a surplus value. That's what it's there. That's what it's about. And the other thing I'd point out is that when it comes to the market, it's true that in the past, in other societies, in say feudal times, for instance, there was exchange of goods, but the primary motive for production was not exchange. It was not that a good portion of what went on was subsistence farming, for instance, right? So when we've broken away from subsistence farming and production for our direct use as individuals or as families or as tribes, and now are producing for exchange, and so the only way you can survive is to go into the market to find everything you need, not just some small aspect, that's what capitalism is about. And the other thing is, capitalism is a great step forward in some ways, because we have a lot more power and we're more socialized and more interdependent now than we were when we were surviving mostly on subsistence farming. And there's been a great increase in longevity because of it. And
I think it's important to distinguish between the creation of wealth and the creation of profit. Okay, profit is simply oriented to the growth of capital. Human wealth is created by science and labor mostly. So, but human creative activity and labor, and so science and labor can be organized in many ways. And so we can credit modernity, not capitalism, with the advancement, you know, with the economic progress. Because in fact, capitalist private enterprise shies away from a risk where profits are not, you know, secured. Currently, we have this problem, for instance, with antibiotics. All right. So even Big Pharma is not jumping on the creation of very much needed antibiotics because they do not see profits coming in that. Or something that made me rather upset recently is everybody is raving about this new company that is harvesting solar energy and saying, you know, Bill Gates is investing, as if, you know, we need capitalism in order to develop these technologies. That technology was already developed by a French school teacher in the 19th century, Augustin Mouchot, I think he was called. And then he was teaching math and physics in school. So progress, wealth creation through human labor and science. Bravo to modernity. But as much as capitalism has helped consumer the introduction of rather a lot of comfort on consumer level, it does not have the guts to invest where profits are not secure. So,
okay, I just feel like describing it as a problem of guts or courage or social, you know, awareness or moral position or any of those things is kind of a mistake. You're quite right to distinguish between like wealth as useful things that we need to survive and maybe luxurious things and profitability. But I would say that the split would be between useful value and the value that's created in a process of exploitation of labor and in terms of time. So, which is what sets up exchanges in a capitalist economy. So the difference between what is called use value and exchange value is where we should look. As long as what we're producing is going to be mediated by exchange values, as long as what we're producing has value because of the amount of time it took to create it, which means as long as we have a working class and that kind of class relation, we're going to have a drive for profitability. And the other thing is that the innovation that we've seen, the scientific innovation, that's often been supported by the state, but it also has come out of the need to innovate to speed up production in order to seek profits. So automation, for instance, comes out of that. So the kind of progress we've seen in modernity is not simply an ideological event. It's not because of the change in people's attitudes or their intellectual capacities or their interests. It's also because of the practical demands that are made on people because of the capitalist dynamic. So a really unfortunate problem for radicals like me is to think of a way that, like, what we have to try to understand is how can we hold on to these values of modernity, like the scientific values or the desire to be interdependent and to expand human power, say, and let go of the thing that up until now has driven it, which is the profit motive or the
right.
desire
but
to
But the
experience.
Profit motive is just one way of innovation, of driving innovation. It is not the only way. That's what I'm saying. That capitalism, sure, it has pulled us up through the profit motive, but we don't. It is time to abandon it because the cost of pursuing the profit are becoming way too high for everybody.
I agree. I'm just saying it may be more difficult than what you're suggesting, because abandoning it would be to abandon the major way that these advances have
right,
come about.
That currently.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we don't quite have in mind a new form of production. we don't have socialism yet. You know, we don't, that's something that still needs to be developed. But let me ask you the next question here. So I want to talk about your view of economic crisis. And I also want to give you some time, because I've been very kind of, you know, adversarial. I want to give you some time to discuss more fully what your vision is, because it's not fair to just like dominate the conversation with objections only. So, so it seems to me that your book is coming out of the 2008 economic crisis, that your perspective is informed by that, at least. Maybe it goes back beyond before that. So I just want to ask you to explain how it was informed by the economic crisis and what your perspective is on capitalist crisis in general.
Okay. Actually, I'm not dealing with the economic crisis so much there, but with the fascination with the terminal crisis of capitalism. Back in 2012, even the Financial Times was running a section, a series called The Crisis of Capitalism. So everybody on the left and on the right was fascinated with the impending collapse of capitalism. But this does not come to pass. So I'm observing this shift from the narrative of terminal grave crisis of capitalism onto the more petty debate about inequality. And currently, actually, there is no crisis of capitalism. So I'm saying, if there is no crisis of capitalism, does it mean that we have to abandon hope for radical change? And my answer is no. In fact, we do not need, I'm one of those Marxists who do not believe that radical change is directly correlated with the availability of crisis. In my reading, in fact, crisis makes people more conservative. So, in fact, it diminishes the likelihood of a political action of very, you know, bold, imaginative political gestures for innovation. So I'm saying there is no crisis of capitalism. Capitalism in the sense of the economic engine of prosperity through the pursuit of profit is functioning okay. Even if people's lives have become more precarious. But we do not need that crisis in order to mobilize an anti-capitalist wave of action. So in terms of the crisis, this is my position, that not only that we don't have a crisis of capitalism, we have something I called the crisis of the crisis of capitalism. I can, you know, go into that, but we do not need it.
Well, tell me what the crisis of the crisis of capitalism is, according to
it. All right. So it is a term, in fact, that Derrida in 1992 coined, Jacques Derrida. He noted that even as the crisis, you know, is not happening, there is still a sense that something is wrong, that much is wrong. So, see, when an entity is in crisis, it has three possible exits from the crisis: either death, right? The death of capitalism, healing, so recovery and going back to health, or a radical transformation. But none of those three are happening. So we are stuck in some sort of a permanent inflammation. Neoliberalism entered some sort of a crisis, but all the policies and the rationale and the mentality of neoliberalisms are still there. So people hate it. They are criticizing it. There is, eruption of protest. And yet neoliberalism is in some sort of a zombie state.
Well, I have a bunch of thoughts. Yeah, the crisis. Yeah.
So that is the crisis.
Well, I have a whole bunch of different thoughts that come to mind. And I'm going to start with this. Hopefully we can just turn this into more of a conversation rather than a heated debate anyway. But, after
World War II, my understanding is, especially coming out of the Frankfurt School, there was sort of a thought that capitalism had righted itself through state capitalism in particular, mm-hmm. whether that would be in the Soviet Union or in the FDR's welfare state. There was a new form of capitalism which was no longer going to go into crisis, that was no longer going to be riven by the same contradictions.
Right.
And this was considered to be dreadful by many Marxists because not only absolutely. Did that mean that there wouldn't be no socialism, but also that meant that there might be nothing like a free human subject. Because you would no longer have a person who would be able to see past the ideological categories of the society that they were in, because what gives us that ability are the contradictions in capitalism, whether they're economic or social or ideological.
Right, right.
And this is all being worked out. So like Marcuse wrote One-Dimensional Man, and Cornelius Castoriadis wrote about the death of the human subject and the total domestication of man and on and on. So there were various ways in which this was taken on board on the left, and I think maybe Derrida might be kind of associated with that in a way, not directly, but the fact is, I think it all hinged on a conception of a contradiction that was wrong in two senses. One, there was maybe this idea of a terminal crisis that basically that capitalism would kind of solve itself, that it would run out. And that I don't think is the case. I think that the crisis of capitalism for capitalism is its own solution. That if you devalue capital far enough that you can have a boom, that's what the 50s were about after World War II, right? There's a massive bloodletting. You know, basically, if you make enough sacrifices to the god of capital, you can have a little bit of a respite. The other problem was that there was such an emphasis on the market and exchange relations, and not they kind of turned away from understanding. They like the Marxist theory of labor theory of value was just sort of tossed aside. It was too mechanistic, according to the Frankfurt School philosophers. It was, so all of that meant that they no longer had a sense of where the root of social contradictions were. And they moved on to this realm of the ideological. And I would just say that Derrida is doing something similar.
So they moved away from the political economy.
Political economy, right. They moved away from political economy to ideological critique, cultural critique, psychological critique. They embraced Freud. I mean, this is a simplification, but because they were a big group, actually. But the point is, I think Derrida is making a similar mistake. When he talks about the crisis of capitalism, that may be something some intellectuals are experiencing, but the reality was, we had just come out of the 80s where there was a recession. We came out of the 70s where there was a major recession. Mm-hmm. Neoliberalism itself was born out of contradictions and crisis within capitalism. Mm-hmm. And then it wouldn't be very long until we had, geological time anyway, 2008, a major economic crisis. And we don't know when the next one's coming. That, whether or not that will lead naturally to people responding kind of automatically – as revolutionaries, I would agree. It probably will lead a lot of people, if they're not given any ways to understand the whole system, into a conservative reaction. Right. But it doesn't mean that the
not so conservative, but it can be a reactionary, as we see now. I mean, this far right reaction is out of fear. It's out of losing livelihoods. I don't think it's cultural. It's not all about white supremacism. It is a lot about total destabilization of people's lives. Just to respond to this thesis about crisis and revolutionary action or radical action, I think in my reading, at least, in the book, I see that capitalism reinvents itself. It reboots itself through crisis, managing its crisis. So I have elaborated this theory about the transformation of capitalism through four different lives, or four consecutive forms of capitalism since the 19th century. And I'm observing that sometime already before the big financial meltdown of 2008, around the end of the 20th century, we exited neoliberalism, neoliberal capitalism, and entered another form of capitalism. And that was triggered again by this effort of capitalism to stabilize itself. So capitalism is very creative in finding ways to reinvent itself by managing these crises. So now we inhabit a form that is committed to ensuring, so the top policy priority of our contemporary capitalism is to ensure the competitiveness in the global economy. See, the welfare capitalism was about growth and redistribution. And now the left is hankering for that old model, but I think it's the wrong thing to do. So the imperative of competitiveness in the global economy that replaced the growth and redistribution formula, which was so toxic for the environment, we don't need it. That imperative for competitiveness in the global economy created pressures on everybody, a lot of pressures on the lives of everybody, the rich, the poor, the educated, the poorly educated. So there is good news and bad news. The bad news is this conservative attitude that the massive precariousness creates. But part of the bad news is that democracy gives voice to this conservative attitude. I call that the scandal of democracy. So much as we rely on democracy to lead us to a solution, democracy becomes part of the problem because it currently gives voice to this capital-labor alliance in favor of more growth, more destruction of nature, in favor of stabilization of capitalism. So that's the bad news of the current model of capitalism. The good news is, however, that the form of life this precarity capitalism has imposed on everybody, even the winners see themselves as losers. See, I have looked at surveys even of how millionaires relate to their lives. Most of them believe that they're part of the 99%. They declare that they would prefer to work much less, but out of insecurity, they have to stay on the job and continue, you know, making profits. So the cost of playing the game successfully, the cost of winning at that games are so high that this kind of broad anti-capitalist front of strange bedfellows is now possible. So that's the good news about where we stand currently. This is why I believe that we have more chances to subvert capitalism rather than overthrow it.
Okay, well, I think we need to come back to the difference between overthrowing and subverting in a minute. But before we do that, I just want to clarify the difference between, like, I think I understand what you're saying about the welfare state and what that was. And how would you define neoliberalism?
Okay, neoliberalism is the form of capitalism that came in the 80s and 90s. And its main feature is a certain relation between society and public authority, or society and state, that says, you know, the state is playing hands off. I call that the stepmother state, and is letting markets decide social life. So basically the market takes care of things. This was typical of neoliberalism. That is why it's called neoliberal, right? It's a reproduction of the the first form of the liberal form of capitalism, leaving everything to the market. But towards sometime the close of the 20th century, the state started very actively to interfere and help the most competitive economic actors in order to help them compete in the global markets. When the switch came towards ensuring national competitiveness in the global markets. So the state started to use the redistributive mechanisms it had developed under the welfare capitalism, but now it started using them to distribute from the weak to the strong. So that is one feature of precarity capitalism, that the state actively interferes in order to enhance the already existing advantage of some economic actors to the disadvantage of others. But within this, a very capital labor thing, it cuts across the social class, because the winners of the game are the big companies where capital and labor align because they have a more profitable position in the global economy. And then, smaller companies that are not so competitive, they are at a disadvantage in that game. So there, the capital-labor thing is very messed up because of these processes.
I just think that neoliberalism, as you described it, really never existed. That it's always been a way for the state to intervene on the side of, I wouldn't say of the winners, or I would say on the side of investment. So it's been a way for, after there was after the crisis in the 70s. It's been a way for the state to step in, break from redistributist welfare policies, and instead create welfare for the rich. And I remember there was an anecdote about von Mises being in a conference with Milton Friedman and a few other neoliberal, intellectuals, and he, after listening to them talk for a while, got very upset and said, "You're all a bunch of socialists," and stormed out of the room. And it was because they wanted to use the state to prop up investment and to, in a rational way, direct people to and direct the forces, social forces, to support investment in the market.
Well, sure. I mean, there is no very much a break among between those forms. But one peculiar feature of the neoliberal capitalism is that the state uses regulation to offload responsibility downwards, to offload just to society. So it uses the law to deregulate the labor markets, the product markets. Another feature of precarity capitalism is that, so, if you remember the times, the glorious 90s, 80s and 90s, when, the economy was booming and unemployment was low, everybody was chasing these opportunities. Luc Boltanski and Yves Chiapello described that capitalism as this sexy capitalism of, having it all, chasing the exciting opportunities. Nobody's chasing any opportunities anymore. People are motivated to stay in the game out of fear of fallout, out of fear of losing their job, out of fear of competition. So it is fear rather than opportunity that motivates participation in the game.
Bill Clinton got elected based on the economic crisis of 1991. He would say, at the time, he said, "It's the economy, stupid." By the time he left office, right around 2000, or right after he left office, right around that time when Al Gore was going to run, there was a dot-com bust. There had been a bubble, mm-hmm. and then there was a bust, and everything went into the crapper. And I know people who were flying high in the tech industry who had to go back to regular jobs. So the 90s that we're talking about, where there seemed to be like no end in sight, was actually fairly short, like maybe 8 years, 7-8 years. And the other thing is, even then, the left was still talking about the fact that all this economic success only hurt working people. It was funneled to the top. And today we have a similar situation where there's an economic boom going on. Trump can tout all of these great figures. Mm-hmm. But I know people who can't afford to live in their homes anymore because they're renters and...
Right, right, exactly. So there is a social crisis, even if there is no economic crisis. And what I'm saying is that it is not so much inequality. It's not that others have more that is the problem, but the poverty. So there are two problems: poverty of much of the population, and then the precarity for everybody. Some very clever people have written about the precarious class. Indeed, that is a huge problem. But what I'm saying is that we have a precarious multitude, and that at the what, even if the grievances of the poor and the rich are different, they all boil down to the same causal factor, and this is the increased competitive pressures for the creation of profit in the globally integrated capitalism. So because what drives this, you know, hell for everybody is the same trigger, the pursuit of profit, then we need to direct action not so much to issues of property distribution and distribution of wealth, but to fight the competitive production of profit.
You just mentioned the multitude. To what extent is your thinking influenced by Hart and Negri and their book Empire?
Right. Their writing, I am influenced, I'm fascinated with their notion of the multitude. But for me, the multitude is the 99%. It is not just the multitude of what is traditionally understood as the precarious class, as the impoverished workers. I think that we are at an unprecedented moment of history where even the winners, what, you know, the people we envy with the good jobs and supposedly great lives, are experience themselves as losers, and that is why this focusing narrowly on resurrecting the class struggle, we're losing an opportunity. It is the way to go. I see that the left is trying to resurrect the class struggle with all this talk about inequality and taxing the rich. I think we're missing an opportunity if we do not capture this larger discontent that goes beyond the traditional working classes.
Okay, I'm going to take my, pedantic Marxist hat off now, okay? So you can breathe a sigh of relief, and I'm going to talk about things going on in the world right now, and from a different kind of perspective. So in the United States, we have Andrew Yang running for president, and we have Bernie Sanders running, and I guess there's a couple other people. but Andrew Yang represents a certain approach where he's interested in universal basic income. He's concerned about automation and the precarity that brings. And Bernie Sanders is focused more on what I would consider to be kind of traditional class politics. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the billionaires and the corruption. And it sounds to me, would you say that Yang might be more, not like he's completely aligned or you want to endorse him, but the spirit of Yang is more what you're interested in than?
Yes, you have a sense correctly. I do believe that Andrew Yang is the person that best responds to the needs of our time. Because his politics, he might sound very soft-spoken, but he is radical in the sense that he believes in the universal minimum income as a possibility of allowing people to get out of the rat race and have better lives, which would directly go against the profit motive. So it is a radical idea. In my reading, anything that goes against the profit motive is radical, and all of the other policies that, including redistribution, the more classical solutions of the left, they stabilize capitalism, and therefore they might add to the problem in one particular way. I call that the paradox of emancipation. See, the more we lobby for equality and inclusion within a certain way of life. Let's say we produce more in order to redistribute. We glorify that model within which we seek equality and inclusion. Like when the women, in the 70s were fighting to enter the labor market, well, they glorified the rat race and they diminished the power of labor because they supplied a lot of labor. So it is very important that whatever progressive forces are out there do not kind of deepen one form or one form of injustice for the sake of strengthening up another form of injustice.
Yeah, I think it's very...
And I feel that our obsession with inequality is exactly that. We are glorifying the mechanism of the production of wealth through the pursuit of profit that is at the cause of all the evil currently in the world.
Marx would absolutely believe and agree with you about emphasis on inequality, because he would say, first of all, it's a matter of what kind of equality you're seeking, and also that true equality has to include inequality. He's a Hegelian, right? That means, for instance, just to be really simple about it, if we all are at a fence, we're trying to look over a fence at a baseball game, say, and we're all equally we're given step ladders that are all equal in size, that's not true equality, because some of us may still not be able to see over the fence because of our different heights, right? So you need some people need more of a stepladder than others. The inequality of distribution of stepladders.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
So,
right. So, well, which reminds me of, Aristotle is often credited with this remark that the worst form of inequality is to try to make unequal things equal. It is even more problematic in a capitalist society that a lot of the production of wealth on which we count in order to redistribute it and fight poverty is driven by the profit motive. So you cannot want to kill the profit motive and still have the outcomes of the profit motive. You need to change the whole production of wealth rather than just hanker for equality and prosperity as everybody is promising.
I'm going to confess something to you. I am, supposed radical. I have at least a Marxist perspective. I work for a for-profit company, and I have a target of expanding our, earnings over the next 2 years.
You're so radical.
For me, the trick is to balance out competing or contradictory motives. Like I know how I could make the company more profitable in some ways, but that I'm not willing to do. Like, for instance, I could focus only on the most trivial political problems. I could even move to the right and become there are some, I'm not going to throw anyone else under the bus, but there are some ways that you can feed the narrative that already exists and contribute very little but make a lot.
Well, listen, you remind me something very important. We live in a capitalist society, and the way to fight capitalism is not to make ourselves poor. So you work for a profit company, you have to play the game in order to play it well, in order to win. Because to lose doesn't change the game. So we have to play the game to win and yet criticize and want to change radically the rules of the game. So there is no contradiction.
Well, there is one, but it's one that maybe we can navigate. How about that? As long as you hold it in mind, you can at least try to sublate it.
Exactly.
I feel like there's a lot more we could say. We're coming up on an hour here. I've talked probably too much. But How are people receiving your book? And do you feel as though people are going to be able to take in this idea that we should break from a certain kind of Marxist or radical politics that emphasizes the radical hope of immiseration and, you know, the need to include everyone into the system that we're trying to overthrow and, you know, all these different problems. Are people taking this up, or are you getting a lot of resistance?
No, actually, when I present my thesis on precarity capitalism, usually people react very well or very and rather strongly to the idea that the real problem of our time is not inequality, but precarity, and precarity not just for the poor and the underpaid, but for everybody. It resonates with people. It seems that this is what is really ailing the 99%. Also, people are reacting well to the idea of subversion rather than overthrowing. Klaus Hofe, the great political theorist, called my approach. He had an early read of the manuscript. Radical subversive pragmatism. I'm very proud of the label, and I hope, and I've decided to live up to that. So let's be radical, let's be subversive, and let's be pragmatists.
All right. Well, I think that's a perfect point to end the interview, and I can play the out music after that, you know, declaration.